This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now, a pre-recorded interview with Stanford Business School's Gregory Martin. Recently, Gregory and his colleague Stephen W. Webster published Does Residential Sorting Explain Geographic Polarization, which is due to come out in Political Science Research and Methods. I hope you enjoy the interview. So I'm here with Gregory J. Martin, an assistant professor of political economics at Stanford School of Business. Thank you for joining me, Gregory.
Hi, yeah, thanks, Joseph. Good to be here.
So earlier this year, Gregory and his co-author, Stephen W. Webster, put out a really cool paper on residential sorting and political polarization. It's called Does Residential Sorting Explain Geographic Polarization? It's a cool paper with some pretty cool implications. And Gregory was nice enough to sit down with me. Gregory, what is it in publication? Has it been published yet? Or
yes, so it's not in print yet, but it is available at Political Science Research and Methods. It's on online right now. It's published online at least. It should be in print later this year or next year, I guess.
Yeah, totally. I was going to say, yeah. So now it'll sit there for anywhere from like 6 months right. to 2 years.
I don't think their backlog is that long, but yeah.
Good. All right, let's start off with your background just so, you know, people know where you're coming from. So which discipline do you come from and where did you study? Who were your mentors?
Yeah, so I'm a bit sort of in between disciplines. My PhD is in political economy. So I actually did my PhD at Stanford GSB. So I've just come back. I was at Emory in the political science department for 5 years after I graduated. I think of myself as a political scientist primarily. My training is sort of in between economics and political science.
So you go to APSA.
I go to APSA. Yes, that's right.
So, and then who are your intellectual role models?
Who are my intellectual role models? That's a good question. My advisor was Steve Callender, who's at the Stanford GSB. And he's also a political economist, sort of he's a formal theorist. So he uses game theory to study politics. And then I also worked a lot with people here in the economics group who are sort of industrial organization economists. So my research is like mostly about sort of the economics of media and sort of how economic incentives of media organizations affect politics. That's sort of my primary research interest. This paper is it's sort of an offshoot. It's not like my main sort of research interest.
Goes to show though, sometimes you can write a sort of a little side paper that does just as well as anything else you'd be putting out. Eh?
Yeah, this is something I started thinking about in grad school actually. So I took a class with Jonathan Rodden, who's in the political science department here. On sort of geography and politics and that's when I got started thinking about it where this kind of question came up. So I guess for this particular paper, I think Jonathan's work on like the relationship between density and political preferences is sort of where this came from. The heritage of this particular project.
Cool. All right, well let's delve right into it, but sort of lay it out for people who don't specialize in politics. So your paper is on geographic polarization, geographically based political polarization. Can you sort of just give us a basic intro to that concept? Like, what is geographic polarization?
Yeah, so geographic polarization just refers to people with similar political preferences clustering close together to each other in space. So it's the like a I don't know simple way or a distinction I guess would be between. If you think about like two towns that are next to each other, a non-geographically polarized distribution of preferences would be like each of those towns has an equal mix of Democrats and Republicans. A geographically polarized distribution would be one town is like 100% Democrat, the other town is 100% Republican, even though the total number, like the total fractions of the partisans are constant in those two scenarios. And one of them, there's much more sort of local concentration of political preference. And that's what we're talking about when we say geographic polarization.
So it's like a situation in which people who live in a particular area develop or have the same political attitudes or preferences. Like maybe like deep red Alabama versus deep blue Massachusetts, or maybe liberal cities and conservative countrysides, that type
exactly,
of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what we're thinking about, is like the concentration of political support in sort of small geographic areas. Yeah.
And where are the most meaningful geographic dividing lines in political politics? Is it as simple as city versus country, or, you know, the South and the West versus the coast? Like, where are the relevant dividing lines?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the U.S. today, I mean, there's certainly a big urban to rural gradient. That's sort of one of the most sort of salient political divisions right now. Although that's, you know, it's much more, it's actually much more fine-grained than that. So it's not just sort of this broad distinction between cities and rural areas. Even sort of within metropolitan areas or within cities themselves, there are meaningful, you know, political divisions, and they tend to correlate, you know, pretty strongly with population density. So even sort of within metropolitan areas, like the neighborhoods that are more dense, that have more people concentrated in a smaller space, tend to be more liberal or tend to vote more democratic. And places that are less dense, that are sort of more sparsely populated, tend to be more Republican leaning. I mean, that's true, like not just at the broad, like the very macro scale of urban versus rural places, but also even like within a city and within a neighborhood, the denser places are where you tend to find Democrats.
So like that, you know, that little island of detached single family homes in the middle of a city is probably more likely to be conservative, whereas yeah.
Exactly.
The part of the with all the high rises is likely to be low. So how do people conventionally explain these dividing lines? Like I'm thinking of the Big Sort.
Yeah. So there's a number of explanations. The Big Sort that you referenced, that the idea in that book is that people are choosing to live near people like them, essentially, that people are sort of physically sorting themselves into neighborhoods that contain people that agree with them on politics.
It's like when Mark Furman moved to Idaho, type of thing.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's the idea that behind that book, that people are sort of choosing to avoid conflict, more or less. Like people want to live in a place where everyone agrees with them, so they don't have to encounter any sort of contradiction to their beliefs.
But you see, there are reasons to question the Big Sort. Like, why do you question it? But before we get into your specific empirics, but coming into it, you know, you had reasons to doubt it.
Yeah, sure. So I mean, there's other papers that have measured people's preferences for like neighborhood preferences on a variety of dimensions. So there's a good paper by Clayton Nall, who's also at Stanford, and John Momolo, who's a political scientist at Princeton, where they surveyed I think like 3,000 or so individuals, and they asked them about their preferences for housing on a bunch of different dimensions. So like housing characteristics, as well as like political stuff, like, you know, do your neighbors agree with you and so on. And, you know, what they found was that those political dimensions are pretty low down on people's ranking. So the stuff that people really care about is exactly what you would think. It's like affordability of housing, like quality of schools, safety of the neighborhood, like these sorts of big important things. And politics sort of falls pretty far down the list. And so just based on that, it's sort of, I think it's clear and that there are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of other constraints that people face when they're choosing where to live. And for most people, politics just isn't the primary driver of like where they're choosing to live.
Yeah. It's like, that's one of those studies where like you get the results and you feel like it was obvious, but like you were so convinced that that wasn't the case before you know, you see the evidence.
Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, I think it's, this is something that's difficult for people that like me, that professionally, you know, study politics professionally. It is, you like, introspection is not always a good source of insight about the world. And it's easy to forget that most people pay very little attention to politics, and it's not sort of their primary source of identity. And so, you know, generalizing from my own experience is sort of how much I think about politics is generally not a good, is not a good way to decide about what's actually going on in the world.
Yeah. It's like, what? Everybody's not interested in my research interests.
Right.
So all right. So Tell us about your study. What were you looking for? What did you find? Like, give us your data, your methods, what you did.
Yeah, sure. So what we were trying to do was to actually measure the degree of partisan bias in housing choice. So we were looking to understand sort of how much, how strong is that direct partisan influence on where people choose to live. The idea being we'd want to know, that quantity is important for understanding whether or not the sort of big sort hypothesis is plausible or not. And so our basic data comes from voter files. So we have two samples. One of them is the entire registered voter population of Florida, in the state of Florida in 2008 and 2010. We use Florida because they make their voter files easily available, and it's also fairly easy because they assign everyone like a voter ID. It was easy to track people over time, moving from place to place. And so we use basically two snapshots of the Florida voter file in 2008 and 2010 to identify a set of people who changed residences in that period.
Nice. What'd you find?
Yeah. So what we find is that there are there is a partisan bias in moving. So Democrats choose to live in denser neighborhoods and neighborhoods that are more walkable. According, so we use the walk score metric, which is like this. A measure that Redfin, the real estate company, provides. It's supposed to measure sort of how many businesses and schools and parks and so on are within walking distance of an address. So we find that Democrats, sort of consistent with the popular understanding of how preferences for walkability correlate with partisan preference, we do find that Democrats choose even if we compare people that are moving to the same place, like people that are moving to the same metro or the same even the same zip code. We find that Democrats choose neighborhoods within that zip code or within that metro area that are more dense, that are more walkable, and that have more Democrats in them already. So there is partisan sorting is a real thing. It does appear that that people have preferences, at least preferences for housing are correlated with political preferences. However, that the actual magnitude of the effect is super small. So it's very precisely estimated because we have. We have a sample of a little over a million people that moved in Florida, and we also have a separate sample of 50,000 people that moved across state borders. So we got that from Catalyst, which is like a Democratic consulting firm that maintains national voter databases. And they gave us a sample of 50,000 people that moved across state lines. So we have like a sort of separate replication sample as well. And in both of those samples, the evidence is consistent in both. We find that those effects are there, and we can measure them very precisely because we've got a lot of data. But they're really small. So the partisan effect is something like, or the magnitude is like a 4% of a standard deviation in the standard deviation of like within state move. So it's very small relative to the overall variation in the data. It just doesn't explain very much of people's moving patterns.
So it's in effect, what you're finding is, yes, there is some type of sorting effect where people gravitate towards communities that reflect their prior preferences, but it's not a strongly determinative factor. Like, yeah, it's there. There's a weak signal, but it doesn't seem to be a core factor.
Right. That's exactly what we find. Yeah. So it's just, relative to everything else that determines people's housing choices, it's just a pretty minor factor. And so what we did, to sort of like actually quantify out what this, how much it matters, what we did is we ran a simulation. So we took all of our Florida voters. And we said, let's imagine that the only thing that can change is people's physical location. So let's like imagine we're in a world where nobody ever changes their mind. Like if you're a Republican once, you're a Republican forever. So the only thing that can change geographic polarization is people physically moving from one neighborhood to another. And let's see what would happen given what we estimated for the magnitude of those partisan biases. And what we find is that when we run the simulation, we find that the residential sorting by itself sort of actually reduces geographic polarization because the partisan bias is just way too small. And the U.S. is already pretty politically polarized. So in order to maintain the very high level of geographic polarization that we have today, you would need a much stronger. So we estimate something like a 5 times stronger partisan bias just to like stabilize, just to maintain what we have now. And given our actual estimates, we find that residential mobility alone sort of homogenizes the distribution of partisans and reduces geographic polarization.
And so you theorize that place is playing a role in shaping politics, that the causal arrow might be running in the opposite direction.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it is true, and this is like robustly true and has been demonstrated in a lot of different contexts, not just in the U.S., this also holds in other industrialized countries, this correlation between density and preferences. And so there must be, you know, given that it doesn't seem like that's being generated by people, you know, people who are relatively liberal moving to denser places, there's going to be something else going on. Given that we observe this robust correlation that holds like at very low scales and very large scales and across countries, we can't explain it on the basis of people's moving behavior. And so there must be something else going on. And we speculate that it's the reverse causal arrow, that, you know, living in a denser place actually leads people to to change their beliefs.
All right. So we're shifting gears now from empirics to theory, right? What do you think is going on here? Like, why would place shape politics?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a couple of things. There's a couple of like theories that I've thought about and I think are plausible. So, I mean, one I'm not the first person to develop this one. I'm trying to think of the reference, but I'm blanking on it.
That's fine.
But one idea is just that, you know, living in a city sort of changes your perception of what are necessary or valuable government interventions, right? Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that like someone who lives, living in like an apartment building might change your perception of sort of how much the government should intervene to sort of reduce, mm-hmm. you know, to reduce externalities, like, you know, dealing with your neighbor's loud music or something like this. Whereas in a...
For example, if you live in a dense area, then cars are less practical and you see the value of mass transit investments.
Sure, exactly. So, right. So there's lots of things like this where your like physical context might change what you think.
Right. But the change there is the physical context alters your policy preferences, exactly. Which in turn might. Okay. So that's plausible.
So that's one possibility. There's another that doesn't sort of rely on the physical context at all, but it's just about social context, where you may adapt to sort of match your immediate neighbor. So this is like about, just sort of adapting to match the beliefs of your neighbor. So it's not to like, what's the word that I'm looking for?
Like introduce politically based friction in your social relationships type of thing?
Yes, exactly. So there's like a specific word that I'm totally blanking on.
Oh, is it like a technical term? Like social capital enhancing?
I think this is a sociology term.
Well, whatever, we get it. And chances are, even if you were to pinpoint the concept, we would just be translating it into our own concepts anyways. So.
Yeah, so that's another, is it sort of like the, it's this sort of purely social influence that just sort of adapt to whatever the majority belief in your, among your sort of social circle is. That's one possibility. And another has to do with income inequality. So I think, living in a city, cities tend to have much more visible income inequality, but they tend to have both like more absolute income inequality, and income inequality is also much more visible in the sense that you see both, you know, if you live in New York, you see homeless people on the streets and you also see hedge fund managers, you know. It's just the degree of income inequality that exists is much more visible in a city, and there's also much more actual distribution or actual variation in incomes in cities than there are in rural areas. And so that sort of changing of the salience of income inequality might also alter your beliefs over, you know, how much redistribution you think there should be.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's like the majority of people in the city will come into contact with richer people and understand that they themselves are not
rich. Right, and understand sort of how much richer the rich are than they are.
Whereas if like the rich guy is the guy who owns the gas station at the intersection of town, you might think you're pretty high class yourself if you're you know, teaching at the local school or something.
Right. So I think that theory is more consistent with the fact that the degree of correlation of preferences, I should say, political preferences with density has increased a lot in the past century. So if you go back to like the 1910s or 1920s, there's basically zero correlation between density and political preference. Mm-hmm. And it only really starts to emerge in the 50s, and it's gotten much like the slope has gotten much steeper since the 1970s. And so I think that story about like, you know, the underlying thing driver being income inequality is more consistent with that story about the visibility of income inequality than the others, which are more static, I guess, and don't sort of don't explain why this gap is widened over time.
That's interesting. So it's like, I guess, is there a line of discourse that maybe talks about like identity and, you know, maybe voting Republican means voting for country in the minds of people, or voting Democrat means voting for the city, and to cross lines is to betray your community. You think there's that type of sense?
Yeah. So I mean, I think it's certainly possible that over time, as the political alignments, like what the parties sort of stand for in terms of policy, that's obvious. That's changed a lot since the 1970s, since the realignment of Southern Democrats to switching over to becoming Republicans. Mm-hmm. That sort of changed the main political cleavages in the country and sort of where those dividing lines fall. Mm-hmm. To be along this much more urban to rural axis. And it's possible that because we've now been in that sort of partisan alignment for a while, those groups, like the coalitions that form each of the parties, have become sort of stronger identities than they used to. And so that the identity of being a city person sort of associates with being a Democrat much more strongly than it would have in the 1920s or something.
So here's a question for you. Like, if place, it strongly shapes people's political preferences or their political identities. Like, does it make sense, for example, for Democrats to try to win over voters in rural areas? Or does it make sense for conservatives to try to win in urban areas if the tie is so strong?
Oh, yeah. No, I think it certainly does. Particularly for Democrats, this is more of a problem for Democrats than it is for Republicans, because of the malapportionment in our, you know, in most of our legislative institutions in this in this country.
Can you just explain that for people who maybe aren't as plugged in?
Oh yeah, sorry. So in the U.S., you know, we have single member districts. Like, we have a geographically defined district which is represented by one person, by like your congressman, say in the House of Representatives, which is determined by, you know, first past the post voting, right? So, so that means that because of the way that this interacts with this correlation between density and preference is that it tends to be that rural places are overrepresented,
right?
Because Democrats are physically concentrated into a relatively small space, right. The result is you get a lot of districts, like especially in New York City, there are many districts that consistently vote like 90% Democratic, right. Congressional or presidential elections. And that's partially due to gerrymandering. That's partly intentional on the part of state legislatures, but it's also, part of it is just unavoidable, right? Because you have such a concentration of people who support the same party in the same place, it's hard to draw a district. It's hard to draw districts that don't create these very concentrated Democratic strongholds in the center of cities. So even if we had like a nonpartisan districting commission that had no partisan motives, you would still tend to have over concentration of Democrats in a small number of districts, and thus at the level of the legislature, you get overrepresentation of relatively conservative rural areas for that reason.
So there's like a systematic disadvantage that Democrats face in getting the reins of power in the federal government.
Yeah. So having your supporters be concentrated in cities is a systematic disadvantage given the way that we apportion seats in Congress and in state legislatures. Because it's geographically based, you don't want to have your supporters concentrated in a single place. You want to have them spread out. You want to have, ideally, you'd like to have a slight majority everywhere. That would be the ideal situation for a party. Right. Democrats have the opposite. They have like a huge majority in a few places, and then they're outnumbered in a much bigger geographic area. That's why, like, whenever you see like those maps, the red and blue maps by congressional district, it looks like the entire country is red, even though Democrats hold a majority.
Right.
The reason is that they're just concentrated in relatively small areas. And so, yeah, certainly for Democrats, this is a big issue.
Right.
They, you know, if they want to consistently hold power at the national level and at the state level as well, I think they need to broaden their base outside of urban areas.
It's hard though, right? Because it's like for example, if they need to broaden their base, but if place is a determinative factor in political preferences and not being in an urban area is, you know, what pushes people towards republicanism, well, then that sort of paints a little bit of an unpromising picture.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's true. I mean, place being determinative for political preferences is true, like, given the how the parties are aligned now.
Right.
And what I mean is like the policies that the parties support. So given the alignment today that we have today, sort of what distinguishes Republicans from Democrats on policy, mm-hmm. given that there is this strong correlation, if that changed, of course, right, the correlation could decrease.
Just to translate that into sort of non-quantitative language, it's like, so you're saying politics as usual will leave Democrats in with this type of political disadvantage unless the meaning of what differentiates Democrats from Republicans changes.
Right. I mean, there's no there's no fixed meaning of what it means to be a Democrat, right? The party decides its platform every 2 years, mm-hmm. And they could change the platform in a way, and they could change the types of candidates they run and the issues that they emphasize and so on, mm-hmm. In a way that would reduce the like urban-rural cleavage and emphasize other kinds of cleavages. Okay. So like one thing that they could do is run on, they could sort of try to shift politics back to more of the sort of the, like class dividing line that we used to have back in the 1920s and 30s, and away from the sort of education and urban versus rural divisions that we have today, right? By emphasizing different issues, running different kinds of candidates, and so on. And so there's nothing essential or fixed about the correlation between density and party preference, right? It's conditional on the policies and the candidates that the parties are currently adopting and running today. And if they were to change that correlation could change.
So like, do you test whether or not people actually change their preferences in response to changing places?
Yeah, we do. So we look at, in the same sample of people that moved, we compare people that moved to relatively Democratic places to people who moved to relatively Republican places. And we find that that conditional on at least the stuff that we can observe, like party affiliation and demographics and so on, people that move to more, so demographically similar people that move to more Republican areas are more likely to switch their party affiliation to the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And people who move to more Democratic areas are more likely to switch their party affiliation to Democratic. So there does seem to be more likely that people sort of change to match the characteristics of the place that they moved to.
Mm-hmm. And is the effect substantial? Like the size of the effect?
The size of the party change effect.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still still relatively rare that people change their party affiliation. And also the base rate is something like one. It's less than 1%. I'm forgetting the exact numbers.
Wow.
But the difference, you know, the differential is fairly large. So I think it's I'd have to go back and look at the paper.
There's also I always wonder, maybe I've observed this in sort of my local politics, that some people use party affiliation as means to an end. So like if you, let's say you're a local business person who wants to cozy up with local legislators, it makes sense to be a Democrat in New York City, because that will get you closer to power, and to be a Republican out, you know,
Yeah. So is it just
ideologically driven or policy driven rather than, you know, pragmatic instrumental?
Right. So that's true. So there are some places where one party is so dominant that if you want to have any influence in politics at all, you sort of need to adopt that party affiliation. So New York City is a good example. Like everything is decided in the Democratic primary. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to have any influence in that, you need to register as a Democrat in order to be able to vote in the primary.
Right.
We're looking mostly at the state of Florida. That's our main sort of our main sample, which it doesn't really have any areas like this that are so have such a one party dominance. And so I think that's not the main driver of that result. Is not sort of people pragmatically deciding to register as the other party in order to be able to vote in the primary, just because there isn't anywhere in Florida that is as concentratedly Democratic as say New York City is.
Amazing. Okay, that was Gregory J. Martin, an assistant professor of political economics at Stanford Business School. We've been talking about his forthcoming paper, Does Residential Sorting Explain Geographic Polarization? Where is it coming out in?
Political Science Research and Methods.
Political Science Research and Methods. Thank you very much for joining us, Gregory.
All right, thanks a lot.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.